Hello, everyone. Welcome to Computer Science E7. My name is Dan Armendariz. I'll be your instructor for this semester. And to begin, I thought that I would start out with something actually kind of cheesy and actually suggest to most of you on the right side of the room to smile for the next, 6 minutes or so. And the reason for that is that I'm taking a photo. And don't worry, your face won't actually come out in the photo unless by some miracle you happen to sit perfectly still for 6 minutes. The whole point of this exercise is that we are taking a special type of photograph. It's a photo with a camera and with a lens, except the lens isn't a traditional lens like you might imagine that has glass ends on it that focuses the light and directs the light into the camera itself, but rather it's just a little homemade thing that I made with a little piece of aluminum that I very painstakingly poked a tiny hole in. And so this type of photo is essentially just called a pinhole photo for this reason. And pinhole photography is actually something that that many people experiment with. And it's something that gives you very, very long exposure times. So when I say that this camera is taking a picture for 6 minutes, that's what I mean by long exposure time. Whereas a typical camera might have a much shorter exposure time. It might have something on the order of less than a second, less than a hundredth of a second even. It might be very, very quick when it takes the photo. But the reason that this pinhole photo is actually kind of interesting as a photograph is that it restricts the amount of light that is allowed to enter into the camera. And so because there's this tiny little hole in the middle of this body cap, so this is called a body cap, by the way, and this was actually the pinhole lens before I modified it. And this is, I don't think I have a picture of it after, but you can see it in the flesh right here. And this is actually a really easy thing for you to construct. If you happen to have some regular film or an SLR, if you have a compact digital camera, it'll be a lot more difficult to do this, but it still might be possible. But if you have either film or an SLR like this, what you can do is you can get an extra body cap, which is basically just a little piece of plastic that goes on the front of the camera before you actually put on any lenses. You can drill a hole right in the center. You're not going to be able to drill a hole small enough, so I recommend drilling a relatively large hole and taking some sort of material like aluminum foil or maybe some really small piece of plastic that you know you'd be able to just poke a very small hole in. You can make your own pinhole photo. And in fact, you can make your own pinhole camera out of a variety of sources. So this one, for example, is a pinhole camera with what's called a medium format camera, and that just deals with the actual size of the film. Rather than the film being 35 millimeters, which is the typical size of film that you might be familiar with, this uses a much larger piece of film. It might be about 6 centimeters by 6 centimeters, so it's a pretty good size of film. And this person constructed a pinhole camera using Legos. And obviously the actual pinhole itself isn't made with Legos, but there is a little piece of some material right in the center that allows you to focus the light onto the film behind it. And so what this actually allows us to do is to take a photograph, but again, it allows us to do it without needing a typical glass lens. And there's upsides and downsides to this, and we'll be talking about this pinhole photo that we take pretty much throughout the semester. It will be interesting as we start talking about some of the more technical details about a camera, about how or why this is actually causing this camera to take such a long photograph, or why, in the end, why everything looks so blurry. And in fact, it will look blurry for a variety of factors. It's not just because it is just a very long exposure. And so one thing that is important to note that I mentioned before, don't worry if you are the camera is pointed at you, it will not come out. You will be very, very blurry. And whether or not that is a flattering photo, it remains to be seen. Every year I'm surprised by the quality of the pinhole photo that comes out. I think that we will have an interesting photo to take a look at shortly. So I mentioned some terminology just a second ago called an SLR. What is an SLR? Well, an SLR is something that you might consider to be a professional camera. It's usually a very large camera, relatively bulky, but the thing that makes it an SLR over other types of cameras is the fact that you can change lenses. So on the left, for example, so this is the same camera on the left and on the right. The only difference is that on the right we have added a lens, whereas on the left this camera has none on it. There's a variety of advantages to having an SLR. So although they are bigger and heavier, they also tend to be faster They also tend to have a little bit more battery life and a bit better performance than out of a camera that you would have, than out of just a regular compact camera that you might find in your cell phone or that you might buy at Best Buy, just a, or any other type of place. So the downsides, though, of these are that it is the bulk. In fact, it is the weight, it's the bulk, and it's the expense. These cameras tend not to be very cheap. An SLR can get SLRs can range in price from about $500 all the way to a small car at about $8,000. And I'm not joking. They can cost an enormous amount of money just for an SLR. But obviously, their capabilities will vary just as much. And most of the time, when you buy an SLR, it doesn't actually come with a lens. Usually, it might come with what's called a kit, in which case you might get a small lens that comes with it. But really, the best way to get the most out of your SLR is to expand your lens lineup, to get more than just one lens, or to get more than just the lens that might have come with the camera, and try to get other lenses as well. So you might have a small lens that is useful for certain things, and you might have a much larger lens that's useful for others. And this sort of variety is what gives an SLR its power. Ooh, looks like our photo is done. I can't believe I blabbed for 6 minutes. All right, let's see what it looks like. Now, you won't be able to see it. It's okay. All right, it's fine. Now, I happened to focus on the only portion of the lecture hall where there are empty seats. So it looks surprisingly empty in the photo, but that's all right. So coming back to SLRs. Now, there are actually a variety of manufacturers that create SLRs. The biggest names are Canon and Nikon, but there's other ones available as well, like Sony, Minolta, Sigma. There's a whole bunch of digital SLRs that are available today. Usually, the reason that you might try to buy a name brand over a non-name brand would simply be because of the lens selection. Canon and Nikon have enormous lens selections. You can buy all sorts of lenses for them, and they're not the only ones that make lenses for their cameras as well. There are third parties that will create lenses for these cameras. A lot of other manufacturers, while they do have a relatively good lens selection, you also have to contend with the fact, well, will they continue manufacturing these lenses? Will more lenses be available in the future? It's a lot of questions that you have to ask yourself. Now, I do want to say that we're going to be talking a lot about SLR cameras this semester, just because they are the most powerful type of cameras that you can reasonably buy and use. And as a result, they have a lot of control, and they have a lot of different features that you will be able to use. And by the end of the semester, you will most likely find yourself needing to use. But I don't want to ever say that a compact camera is not a good camera. That is just simply not the case. Compact cameras can be very, very good cameras. It really depends on your, frankly, anybody can use any camera. It really depends mostly on the skill of the photographer to get a good photo out of it or not. In fact, one of the biggest things that as soon as you start taking lots of photos and you start honing your photographic skill, one of the things that will bug you the most is that, oh, wow, somebody's going to look at your photo and they're going to say, wow, you must have a really nice camera, even if you just took the photo with a cell phone. It doesn't have to be the case that you have a really nice camera to take a really nice photo. Now, of course, it's not to say that the better tools won't do a better job. There are many things that you can do with SLRs that you just can't with compact cameras, but it goes both ways. I don't want to say that compact cameras, I don't want to trivialize compact cameras and say that you should not use them. There's no reason to be elitist about these types of cameras because many of them function very, very well. So what do I mean by a compact camera? It's basically just any digital camera that is not an SLR. So this might come in terms of a camera phone. A lot of iPhones or Android phones have cameras built into them. It might even be the normal type of camera with the built-in lens that you might see like those two on the right. And so some of the advantages of these over other cameras might be that they are cheaper, that they're smaller, they're more compact, they're easier to travel with. You can take them all sorts of places. And there's even now a lot of very niche-like compact cameras, where there are some that are very, very waterproof and very drop-proof, so you can take them rafting, for example, or you can do water sports with them and not really have to worry about breaking them. Whereas SLRs, even though they do have, especially a lot of the higher-end ones, do have very good splash protection and drop protection and a lot of and very good construction, you just can't submerge them in water like you can some of these compact cameras. So again, there's reasons why you might want to have a compact camera in addition to an SLR. And in fact, eventually you might want to have both, because they do serve a very different purpose. You might have an SLR to do all of your sort of artsy, very nice photos, and you might just have a compact camera to do quick and dirty shots. Like if you're going to sell something on eBay or Craigslist, you just need a quick photograph, you might just use a relatively good, or not even, or just any compact camera, frankly. And in fact, just to prove a point that compact cameras really do not need to be very fancy in order for you to take good photos with them, I want to show you this. So this is a blog post from, I think this is now several years old, probably 2007 or so, where somebody gave a variety of not just compact cameras, but one-time use film cameras. Remember those when you go to CVS or Walgreens? You'd buy these one-time use cameras, and they would be very simplistic. They would have a shutter, and they might have a flash, and that was basically it. After you took 30 or so photos, you'd bring it in, and you would have them processed, and you would get the photos back from the photo processor. So they gave these one-time use cameras to a village in Lesotho, and they asked the villagers to just document their lives, to see how they live, just to take photographs of things that they do in their normal everyday life. And frankly, some of these photos are absolutely fantastic. And these people have had no training, no photographic training. They've not picked up a camera before, and yet they have been able to take very good photos. And so what's the reason for this? Is it because the camera is good? Not necessarily. It's because they have something interesting to show. And this is something that's really important when we're taking photographs, is how do you take an interesting photograph? And this is something that I battle with constantly. I take photos and I look at it and I say, is this photo interesting? And depending on how I feel, I might say, yeah, this photo is kind of interesting. And sometimes I might say, no, this is a stupid photo. I want to throw this out. And it's gotten to the point where for a couple of years, I just didn't want to take any photos at all, because I'd become so familiar with my surroundings and I've seen everything that, so I come here, I go home, I might travel down to New York, but that was pretty much it. I didn't get to see many things that were different or that were interesting. And so as a result, it was hard to take photos that were different or that were interesting. And so one of the things that we want to do in this class, and that you'll see, is that we will actually have other people critique your own photos and try to tell you whether or not they think the photo, they'll comment not only on the technical aspect, but also whether or not the photo is interesting. And this is a way of getting an outside perspective of a photo, because I can see other photos, and even though it might be a photo that someone else had taken in a place that's very familiar to me, so maybe somebody had taken a photo around here at Harvard, it can still be an interesting photo. But just because they had taken it, and I'm removed from that aspect, it can appear to be an interesting photo. And so this is something that you should strive for, not only technical proficiency, not only very nice artistic skill, but also trying to make your photos interesting and worthwhile to look at. And I mention this not because it's a requirement of the course to have interesting photographs, but just because as you grow as a photographer, you will eventually reach this point where you'll question your own work about whether or not this is a good photo and what makes it a good photo. And I think one of those things is whether or not a photo is made to be interesting. Okay, so moving on. So we've talked about cameras, compact cameras, digital SLRs, but we really need to talk a little bit more about how light travels along from the outside world into a camera and the photo is actually taken. And so there is this diagram that looks a little confusing, but it doesn't need to be. So we can just imagine that this is a typical SLR camera, so just like this, except it is, you're viewing it from this angle. So you're viewing it from the left side. So in other words, the lens is on the front here, and you can see the light that's traveling into the lens and that way. Okay, so with that in mind, with us oriented a little bit on this camera, Let's take a look. So you'll notice that things here are numbered. And number one here, I already gave it away, is just the lens. The lens is the object that focuses the light and directs it into the camera. And eventually, the ultimate destination of this light will be the film plane, number four back here. Now, the film plane might actually be a digital sensor in the case of digital cameras, or it might actually be a piece of film in the case of film cameras. But in any case, the light has to be focused somehow, and that is through the lens, and eventually the light will be focused onto the film plane number four in the rear. Now, we've obviously skipped over a bunch of these numbers, and all of these are very, very important. So really, to just take a photo, all you need is number one and number four. But if you want to be able to look through the viewfinder, if you want to actually be able to see what sort of photo you are going to be taking, then you need to have a little bit extra complexity in this system to be able to do this. So that is exactly what number two is. So number two is a mirror. And this mirror redirects the light that's been focused from the lens, and it redirects it upwards into the pentaprism, which is at the top number seven. Now, the pentaprism reflects the light around internally. You can see it bounces off the top, then it goes to the far left before it bounces to the right. And this refocuses the light so that when it appears through the eyepiece, number eight, it is focused and you will actually see the same thing that the film plane will see. So in other words, there is a scene. So let's say that I'm going to take a picture of this room as it is, and I hold the camera and the light from the room is being focused by the lens into the camera. Well, when I'm looking through the viewfinder, and this is the case of an SLR, compact cameras are a little bit different, when I'm looking through the viewfinder, the light is actually being reflected up from a mirror, this number two mirror right here, and it goes through this pentaprism, which gives this SLR its distinct shape. This is why SLRs have the bulge on the top. It's because there is a pentaprism mirror up top that reflects the light that comes from this mirror, number two, into the eyepiece that you view from the top rear of the SLR. And so this setup allows us to frame and see the scene exactly as the camera will take it. Now, the reason that this is important is that, number one, the lens might change. We might change the lens from this lens to this lens, and that might make it look very, very different. That could make the scene appear more zoomed in. It might make the scene appear more zoomed out. It could make the scene darker or lighter or a variety of other things. And the reason that we would be able to preview that is through this pentaprism number seven up top. And in fact, if you have an SLR, it's very, very easy for you to be able to see the mirror. And I know it will be difficult there. I have a better view of it for now. But just to show you, if we take off the lens that was on it here, you can just see the mirror that's reflecting light up into the pentaprism. And again, I have a fancy little video that will show all of this to you. So there's a couple of other things if we want to get into a little bit more complexity. Let's see. So number eight is the eyepiece, and this usually also has a diopter, so it usually has a little mechanism that you can move to actually change So if you are, for example, nearsighted, you can actually change the diopter so that it appears as though the image is closer to you or farther away from you. So it's just a small adjustment. Usually the eyepiece will allow you to have a small adjustment to correct for your non-perfectly created eyes. And don't worry, I am very, very blind. I have contacts and I cannot see. I'm not blind. I am so nearsighted that I cannot see, you know, the chart, the big E on top, I can't see that. So this doesn't help me at all, but it might help you if you have less crappy eyes than I do, and hopefully that is certainly the case. Okay, so one more thing that's interesting is number five, the focusing screen. Now, sometimes if you have an SLR and you look up inside of it this way, directly in, you will be able to see this focusing screen. And usually this focusing screen is what allows you to, especially in the older film SLRs, if you might remember, there was a circle in the middle and one would be darker, one would be lighter, and it would help you focus. This is what the focusing screen is. It also gives you all of the overlay on a digital SLR. So you might see some black boxes or some black dots in your screen. It is typically found near that focusing screen number 5 here. So in a compact camera, things are a little bit different. There's no reflex mirror here, number 2. There's no pentaprism, number 7. Typically what you see in a compact camera or in a camera phone or a smaller digital camera is that it will remove all of this extra complexity. You will have a built-in lens, this one here, number 1. You will have the film plane, number 4. And whenever the sensor is on, whenever the camera is on, it is just reading the light that's coming in from the lens and displaying it to you on a screen on the back of the camera. Now, sometimes some cameras will have something called an electronic viewfinder. Don't be fooled. That means essentially the same thing as the compact camera where you have a screen on the back, but it is a screen that they put inside of a standard viewfinder, and it gives you more of the perception that you're looking through an SLR, but this is still a digital thing. It's not actually reflecting the light, and you can usually see the little pixels. And some people prefer that, others don't, but I think even recently we're not seeing that so much anymore as the past couple of years, but those things do still exist. Now, one thing that I stupidly glossed over, in fact didn't even mention, that is really, really important to an SLR is number 3, which is the shutter. So the way that this SLR camera is able to take a photo is that there's a couple of mechanical things that has to happen. So the light is being focused from the lens, but by default, it's being focused from the lens and bounces off the mirror, number 2, into the pentaprism. There's no way, or none of the light really from this mirror is being sent back to the rear, to the film plane or to the sensor, number 4. So what this means is that when I try to take a photo, it will be black because there's no light that's happening. So there's a series of events that has to happen for this to be fixed. And that is that number 2 moves up out of the way. It swings up. That is this arrow that you see. It actually will swing up next to the focusing screen, and that will allow the light to travel from the lens back to number 3, the shutter. Now, we could potentially just have this mirror move out of the way, and then we could move it back down when we're done taking the photo. But the problem with this is that the mirror tends to be kind of large, and even though it's to us it's light, to a camera it's heavy and it's difficult to move and it's slow to move. So there's no precise control that the camera has over how quickly this mirror can move up and then back down. So to take truly fast photos, some of the on the order of 1/2000th of a second, 1/4000th of a second, we have to have another mechanism, which all cameras have, all SLRs have, called a shutter, which is here number 3, which is basically just like plastic curtains that cover the film in front. And when we're ready to take the photo, the mirror moves out of the way, it swings, and in fact that's that distinctive SLR slap that you hear. That's the noise, is that mirror moving up out of the way and hitting some stops next to the focusing screen. Then the shutter opens, so the shutter, well, it's just like some curtains, it just opens up and it exposes the film or the sensor. Then the film or the sensor records the light that comes into it, and then when the camera decides that the exposure is completed, it closes the shutter, and then it brings the mirror back down. And in fact, we can see this in action. There's a, thanks to the power of the internet, we have a couple of photos. So let's just take this digital camera. So this is a Canon 5D, and you can see that this is the front of the camera. So again, this is as if we are looking, the lens is removed, and we are looking at the mirror at the end of the camera. So if I hit play here, we will see as the person takes the photograph, the mirror moves up and out of the way. You see it bounces a little bit, and this is what I mean. The camera just does not have very good control over it. And the shutter opens and then closes. So take another look. So here the mirror moves up out of the way, and the shutter, it's pretty quick here, but the shutter opens, and then there's another shutter that closes right behind it. And so in this way, and this might be sort of a novel idea, that there is no, for many exposures, there is no one moment in time where the entire film or the entire sensor is available to have light shining on it. Let's see, where is it? Now let's see if I can be fast enough to pause it just in time. All right, so like right now, for example, there is a brief moment in time where only part of the sensor is exposed. So if there is something that happens very, very quickly, we might actually see some weird sort of artifact. In fact, this comes into play when we will talk about flash exposure in a few weeks' time. This actually makes a big, big difference when we're trying to take an exposure with flash, because flash happens in an instant, and sometimes you might see some black in an image because of this very reason. Sometimes the shutter might just be blocking part of the film or part of the sensor, and it will not be exposed properly. Okay, so this is a 5D. So this camera, you'll notice something that's kind of interesting about it, and you'll notice it even more when I show you the next video. But this camera has something that's called a full frame sensor. So in this camera, this is a digital camera that has a sensor that where the size is essentially the same as a regular 35 millimeter frame. So if you go to CVS or Walgreens and you buy some film, if you can find film, and you buy film and you look at the size of the film negative itself, that is the size of this sensor here. Now, not all cameras actually come with sensors that are that large for a variety of reasons, mostly because they like to differentiate in cost between their various models. So they will have cheaper models or less expensive models that have a much smaller sensor. So you can see here, we're still looking again at the front, and this metal ring hasn't changed in size, but you'll notice that it just looks much smaller. The mirror is much smaller, and the sensor is much smaller. So let's see, do I still have, let's see. So if we go back to 5D, just to compare, you can now see that it is much, much bigger than this other one. So this is a 5D. The other one that I was showing you is a 50D, which is a less expensive SLR model by Canon. You'll notice something else additionally. Take a look at the pentaprism at the top and its size and shape on this camera compared to the 5D, which is much, much larger. The reason for that is a similar thing. It's reflecting much more light from this mirror up into the mirror, and it has to be able to bounce that very large frame, all of that light, into the eyepiece in the rear. So you will typically see on full frame cameras a much larger pentaprism. But okay, let's return back to our original idea here, or to our original topic, which is this idea of allowing the shutter to open to expose a photograph. So the person takes a photograph, the mirror flips out of the way, the shutter opens, and then it closes like that. And you'll notice actually something additional that's interesting, and again, I'm glossing over many things just because the complexity of these cameras is relatively high, and I'm trying not to inundate you too much. But if you look very closely in this video, you'll notice that there is another mirror behind the main one. So there's the main one that's at a 45 degree angle upwards, and then there's a much smaller one that's at a 45 degree angle downwards. And so when I said that this mirror flips up out of the way, that is certainly true, but in all modern cameras, you'll have this secondary mirror here as well. So just to prove to you that this is happening, I'll rewind a little bit, hit play. Oh no, not far enough, I guess. Okay, now we'll hit play. Now watch underneath. Do you see that second one? It flipped up underneath the primary mirror very, very quickly. So there's a secondary mirror that does something. So why might there be this primary mirror that's at a 45 degree angle up and a secondary mirror that's at a 45 degree angle down? Why might we have this secondary mirror in an SLR camera? Yeah. So it doesn't go black in the viewfinder. So that's why we have the primary mirror. So it bounces the light upward into the viewfinder, into the pentaprism. But now we have this, what's that? Well, that is actually something that happens in SLRs by necessity, is that when the mirror goes up, because that mirror is up, there's no light being reflected into the pentaprism. So when you take a photo with an SLR, for a brief moment in time, the viewfinder goes black as it's taking the photo, because the mirror has to come up out of the way, and then that blocks the light into the viewfinder because that light is going instead into the film or the sensor. So there's, and that this secondary mirror is also being flipped up also. So it is up against the primary mirror. Yes.
Is it for light metering?
Yes, good. So there's a couple of functions that the camera does for us, modern cameras. So it will do light metering. So for example, how the camera decides what exposure values to use. It will tell you what shutter speed to use. It will tell you what ISO to use. It will decide all of this based on the quantity of light that is reflected down from the secondary mirror into a very small, and you typically won't be able to see it because the primary mirror is in the way, but there is a very small sensor underneath that does this additional metering. And there's even something else that's there. And in fact, I think, let's see, so it depends on the cameras. Some might do metering via this secondary mirror, but I think many will do autofocusing. So it will decide whether a photo is in focus or out of focus based on a sensor that's down there in the bottom of the camera. Let's see. I don't know if we will be able to see it, but usually it's just a small. Well, it's sort of difficult to see, but you can see there's like a little black hole right here. That is a little hole that allows the light to enter and for this autofocus or metering sensor to be present and do all of these functions for us. It will decide then the settings to use when it's taking a photograph, and it will decide whether or not an image is in focus. But I will suggest to all of you that if you make it to the end of this course, and you very much can, and you will be very proud of yourself if you do, that you will not use many of those things for the duration or for a variety of time in the course. You will end up actually using a lot of the manual settings within a camera because it gives you more control over the camera, over the type of exposure that you're going to take. Don't worry, I'm not going to throw you to the dogs and tell you to start doing that immediately. We're going to start talking about exposure first in the upcoming weeks before we start doing that. Now, to just compare, I think I want to show you a film camera. So an SLR film camera is the same sort of thing. Even though it uses film rather than a sensor, its basic design is the same. It still uses a mirror, which against this crop sensor or the small sensored camera that we saw before looks absolutely massive, but it has exactly the same thing. The mirror flips up, you see the secondary mirror in the background, the shutter opens and then closes, exposing the film in the back, rather than a digital sensor. Now, one of the neat things about having a film in the back is that we can remove the back and take a look at it from the rear. So we could see the same thing from the very back of the camera as when there is no film installed. So this is the back of an SLR camera, and when an exposure is taken, the shutter will open and close. You'll notice that it's just a small slit that slides across here. So one interesting question that we might have is why was the open slit between the shutters, the front and rear shutter, why was it so narrow in this one versus being much wider when in the other cameras? And I'll give you a hint. It's not that it is because it is horizontal or vertical, but there is a very good reason for why one camera would have a shutter space that's much wider than another camera that would use a much smaller space between the shutters. Any ideas? Yeah?
Exposure time.
That's right. So exposure time. So the amount of time that the film is actually exposed to light is much less when it looks like this, because it's this very narrow band of light that's being exposed to the film or to the sensor, whereas the other ones, when it had a much larger gap, there was much more time available for light to gather into the film or into the sensor. Yes? Does it mean that the film is more sensitive to light than the digital sensor? If we were to, yes and no. So it might mean that if these exposure values were correct, but I think when they took these videos, they just set the camera to some exposure value so that they could take these videos appropriately. And I would wager a guess that they just set the camera to, it just by coincidence, it has a faster shutter speed here. But yes, that is a good point, that in order for us to get a faster shutter speed, we actually might need, for the same amount of light, one of the things we could do is have more sensitive film or a more sensitive sensor that would allow us to have a faster shutter speed. But we will talk more about that in the upcoming exposure lectures. Now, one more thing that I want to mention, and something that we can see when we're viewing the shutter from the rear of the camera rather than the front, is that the camera has to actually re-engage the shutter. It has to move the shutter back to its original spot. And before, you couldn't see that very well because that was happening at the same time that the mirror was falling. But in this case, you can. You can see this is where the film is being exposed. Now, it is going to return back to the left. And back in the film days, this was useful because the same mechanism that advanced the film, which is the things that you see spinning on the right, was also the thing that would re-engage this shutter. So just to show you one more time, so pay attention more to what's going on this right side. You'll see that the film is going to advance. At the same time, it is moving the shutter back into position. Now, there's one more thing that I want you to pay attention to in this video, and I'll play it one more time. We have the viewfinder at the very top of the camera. Watch what happens when it takes the photo. Watch the viewfinder. Don't watch the shutter. It gets dark. And that's because, again, the mirror moves up out of the way, so there's no light that's entering into the prism, and therefore you won't see anything in the viewfinder until the mirror drops back down again. That is exactly that mechanism that you see here. Okay. Any questions? All right. Now, this is what gives our SLRs their distinct shape. This is what gives our SLRs their distinct sound. And many of these cameras will have very different sounds just based on the action of the mirror slap. And that is what it is called. The sound that you hear is called a mirror slap because it slaps the stoppers that are up at the top of the camera. Oh, I need to have this on there. Now, one of the dangers about having this be exposed in a digital camera, and we didn't really have to worry about this too much in the film world, but in the digital world, one of the bad things about exposing the camera like this to just the outside world is that dust may travel beyond the mirror back here, beyond the shutter, and onto this film sensor itself. So we might actually get some dust on the camera, and there's a variety of ways that we might combat that, but we will talk about that in just a little while. But for now, there's something that I want to point out. So there's a symbol on pretty much every SLR that's worth its salt that looks like this. It's a circle with the vertical line through it. And this symbol, it doesn't have a lot of meaning in a compact camera, but it's actually really useful, or relatively useful, in a digital SLR, because it tells you exactly where the film plane exists. So if you were to draw a plane straight through the camera right there, that tells you exactly where the front of the sensor in the camera is. So on my camera, it's up here, and I can tell that, okay, my sensor will be down in this way. And the reason that this might be useful is to do maybe some manual calculations that we will actually get to again in a few weeks' time when we're actually talking about using this pinhole camera. We can actually calculate the size of the hole just based on the photo that we've taken here. And you'll see, we'll show you all the stuff that that allows you to do that. But this film plane marker tells you where the film plane is and therefore tells you how far from the back of the camera it is. Now, this film plane location is constant between cameras from the same make. So Canon, for example, all of their cameras that use this particular mount. So if you have a Canon camera and if this lens fits on it, that mount has a certain set of specifications. And one of those specifications tells the manufacturer that, okay, the sensor must be this far back from the location of the mount right here. And the mount is just where the lens attaches. It's this metal ring that's right here. So in Canon cameras, at least, I think it's something like 50 millimeters or something like that. It's some known value from the rear of the camera. But this can be useful for other things as well. Like if you're going to do some panoramics, this might actually be useful for you to know where the location of the sensor is. Anything that lets you remove some artifacts just by knowing where the light is being focused onto the film plane, you will benefit from having this particular knowledge Here. So this, again, is only found on SLRs, or I've only ever seen it on SLRs. The reason for that is that it's not really that useful on a compact camera, because the lens is built into the unit. It's just not going to be extremely useful for you to know where the sensor is. It just doesn't matter that much. You really don't have to know, and you really don't have to care. Okay, so to come back to this idea that I was referring to before, where we actually might be able to get dust into the camera itself, we might see the reason for that a little bit more easily here. So it is possible. Now, one of the reasons that we might get dust is because of the way that we change lenses. So if I'm exposing the internals of my camera to the outside world like I am doing now, for minutes at a time, maybe as the air circulates around, some dust will flow into it. Maybe if I'm careless and I change lenses with the camera pointed up like this, some dust might get into it. There could be dust that falls into a camera for a variety of reasons. But another reason that you might get dust on your sensor is that there's all of these little bits from the outside of the camera internally have been machined. And sometimes there will be just little traces of plastic or little bits left over from the actual manufacturing process of the camera. And those will become loose as you use the camera. So as the mirror moves up and out of the way, it might jar some tiny particles of plastic loose. And this isn't necessarily a manufacturing defect. There's not really necessarily anything that can be done about it. It's just a fact of life that we're going to get dust everywhere, including inside of our camera. And because of the fact that SLRs can actually open their shutter and you can actually see the raw sensor in the back of the camera itself, and in fact, we could go do that same thing on this camera here. Let's see. Did I turn it on? All right, there you go. So now the mirror is up and out of the way, and what you're seeing now is the sensor. So if any of you are very proficient at spitwads, now would be a good time to make me very, very sad, because you could put something directly onto the sensor itself and potentially ruin it. You could do something very, very bad. I've seen people have approached me saying, oh, I was trying to clean my sensor with some liquid and I spilled it all over the inside and now it's a big mess. Now I have a big spot on my camera, so on and so forth. It's risky in a way to have it exposed to the outside world, but it's also very, very powerful because of these additional advantages that these cameras can afford to us. So when we have dust on a sensor, how can we fix this? Now, one of the ways is to just take a digital photo and touch it up using some software like Photoshop. So for example, you might have a photo that looks like this, which actually is pretty good, but the original photo might have some dust on it. Let's see, so pay attention right here. There's some dust right here. There's some dust right here and dust right here. And I'll switch back and forth between the dusty and non-dusty versions, and hopefully the dust becomes sort of apparent on these two images. So if you were to just look at this photo, and you might notice the dust speckles, but it's not really that obnoxious. It's not really going to make or break the photo. But to you, the photographer, you will notice this because these dust specks tend not to move. Once they're on the sensor, they tend to sort of stay in place. And as you take photo after photo after photo and you're going through them all, you'll notice those three dust specks there constantly in all of the photos that you take. And it is so frustrating. You will be so annoyed that you have all of these photos that have dust on them and you have to try to correct it. So in this case, I used a little bit of Photoshop to try to smudge them out a little bit, and I think it's a decent job. If you were to actually take a look at the raw photo, you'd probably be able to see where the smudges are, but it's less offensive now than it was before, I think. Yes. Now, let's see. Do I want to show this? I do have a video, which I think is sort of silly, but there's this new technology that a lot of cameras have that allow the camera to automatically clean the dust off of them. And unfortunately, the only video I have is very marketing heavy from Canon. You'll notice that I have Canon materials, and a lot of the photos and videos that I show you are of Canon cameras, but it doesn't apply just to Canon. It applies to the other manufacturers as well, like Nikon, Sigma, Sony, all of these other cameras that have SLRs. They might have this same technology available there. So let's take a listen and see just how silly this particular thing is. Oh.
Dust adhering to the sensor of a digital SLR camera may have entered the camera from outside during lens replacement, or it may have been generated inside the camera. When dust adheres to the filter on the front surface of the sensor unit, its shadow appears on the photo. An EOS digital SLR camera is equipped with one of three types of imaging sensor: APS-C, APS-H, or 35mm full frame size. Canon has developed a comprehensive system to eliminate the problem of sensor dust for each type of EOS sensor. The solution is the innovative EOS integrated clean system. First, the system prevents the generation of dust. Canon uses various mechanisms and materials to prevent the generation of dust inside the camera. Second, the system prevents the adhesion of dust. The filter incorporates anti-static properties, preventing dust from adhering to the sensor unit due to static electricity. And third, the system removes dust that still adheres. To deal with dust that adheres despite these measures, Canon developed the self-cleaning sensor unit. Ultrasonic waves vibrate the filter on the front of the sensor to shake off the adhered dust. This unique Canon system requires minimal space because a special filter is not necessary, allowing the camera's compact size to be maintained. The self-cleaning sensor unit operates automatically whenever the power is turned on or off. But even when it is operating, priority shifts to shooting mode when you press the shutter button, so you never miss a photo opportunity. Furthermore, the application software that comes with the camera, Digital Photo Professional, has a dust delete function that is effective for any dust that may remain. Software processing makes the dust marks inconspicuous, preventing dust generation, preventing dust adhesion, and removing adhered dust. From APS-C to 35mm full frame, the EOS integrated...
All right, that's enough marketing speak. Now, I show this, again, not to highlight this Canon technology, but just to say that many manufacturers have the same sort of thing. Not only do they have the software that allows you to do it, and in fact, you can just use generic software, third-party software, to remove dust, but also a lot of them have the same sort of ultrasonic sensor vibration technology that actually moves the, not the sensor itself, but the filter in front of it. There's a very small filter in front of the sensor, and it just shakes the dust off. And for many years, I was skeptical, and in fact, I think the first few systems were just not that effective. But I think now the newer cameras are starting to get pretty effective with this. The most recent camera that I have, it has this dust removal thing, and it does seem to work relatively well. But it seems sort of silly at the same time, because it's just shaking off the dust and moving it to the bottom of the camera, and you're moving the camera around, so the dust is just going to get back on the sensor at some point anyway. So at some point, if you have truly bad dust on your digital camera sensor, and you notice that the dust cleaning function doesn't actually remove it, you might actually have to go in and try to clean it yourself. And this can be a kind of harrowing and scary process the first time you do it. There's a lot of products out there that help you do this. Some of them, there's this one company that I like in particular, and I'm sure that there are others as well that have these things, but the one that I have that I really enjoy is this company called Visible Dust. Now they seem to have all these silly, stupid products that in addition to this, but before what they had, and they're very proudly made in Canada apparently, is that it was just a very simple brush. And you might look at it and you might say, well, it just looks like a painter's brush. But if they are to be believed, they don't just use regular acrylic brush, little brush bristles. they seem to use some sort of material that will actually become statically charged. So what you're supposed to do is take an air can and blow air through the bristles, and what that will do is that it applies a little bit of a static charge on the bristles themselves. And what this allows is that as you open up the mirror for sensor cleaning, and on most SLRs, if not all, you'll actually find a function somewhere in the menu that allows you to, it's called like sensor cleaning or mirror open or something like that, that allows you to just keep the mirror open for periods of time. You can then very carefully brush the dust away from the sensor. And I like this method. There's a lot of people that tend to use liquids on the sensor. I'm not a huge fan of those, but if you want to try it, then be my guest, but just be warned that it seems like a bad idea from my point of view to put some liquid on the sensor itself. So I like this dry method a little bit more, but hopefully your camera might have one of these dust removal functions that operates relatively well. Yes? It is, but only if the static discharges, and I don't think that there's enough of a charge built up on the bristles to actually discharge onto the camera. I certainly have never had a problem using that, but if you're not comfortable with that, then you could probably just do away with using the air can on that on the bristles of the camera. Okay, any questions on this so far? Yeah. I would not suggest using a vacuum cleaner. I think you would. I don't know what would happen, and I don't think they're very sensitive. I don't think you would break easily, but I don't know if you would jostle something loose. I don't know if that would happen. So I would not recommend using a vacuum cleaner. Or I also do not recommend just going to Home Depot and buying a little paintbrush, because usually what will happen is that those bristles, even though they're attached, they don't really care if one or two fall off, and you might get a bristle or two stuck inside of your camera. That's not a good situation to have either. So you just want to make sure you have something that's specific for this. This is not something you want to mess around with, I think. Yes?
Just a quick note, the static from a vacuum can kill circuit boards.
I'm sorry?
A vacuum cleaner can generate enough static to kill circuit boards.
Okay, so a vacuum cleaner can generate enough static charge to kill a circuit board. So from that point of view, yes. But I think just the motion of the, you know, the sucking air motion, I don't think that would necessarily do anything bad, but I wouldn't try it. It just seems like an all-around bad idea, in addition to now this idea of...
Would it be worth it to have professionally cleaned in that case?
Professionally cleaned, that might be expensive. You might, if you're really not comfortable, you might have it done professionally. But I think doing it, especially if your camera does not have a dust removal function or does not have the ability to move the sensor, and older ones may not, and that's perfectly all right, you will end up doing it kind of frequently, depending on how frequently you actually take photos. So it's better, I think, to do it yourself, because when in my older camera did not have a dust removal, dust shaking, anything like that, and when I was taking lots of photos, I had to do it every week or every other week, literally, to make sure that I got all of the dust out of the camera. All right, any other questions? Okay, let's take a quick 5-minute break, and when we come back, you will be blown away with the numbers and speed of modern digital cameras. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. So again, if you quite haven't finished the sectioning forms, you just go ahead and fill that out, and we will collect them near the end. And we have the third handout, which is just the assignment, and we'll talk more about that in just a little bit. Now, to continue, there's some interesting things when we're talking about the actual data that goes through a camera itself. And so you can tell that although you're usually not exposed to it when you're actually taking a look at a camera directly, they are made up. It's essentially a small computer. And many of these cameras, especially modern ones, are very, very powerful small computers. And there's a whole bunch of little chips and stuff that are inside of them. And usually the manufacturers are very, very proud of their chips. So Canon, for example, loves to talk about their Digic line of chips. And it's all sort of silly and meaningless until you realize that some of the quantity of data going through these cameras is actually quite ridiculous. So one of the first cameras I had was made in 2004. It was a Canon 20D. It was a cropped camera, so it wasn't a full frame. And it was 8 megapixels at the time. So it was about 3,500 pixels wide by 2,300 pixels tall. So that's how many pixels we're in the image. And if you're not familiar, a pixel is just the small dot that represents a color. So it's just the number of dots across by the number of dots down. So you multiply those two together, and it's about 8 million pixels. Now, the camera also took that photo, an 8-megapixel photo, about 5 times a second. So it can do it, so it can take an 8-megapixel photo every 5 times in every second. So if you do the math, you multiply it all together, you calculate how much color can actually be processed in addition to the number of pixels, you'll actually realize that this camera was capable of processing 60 megabytes per second worth of data. And to put that into an idea, so an old floppy disk drive, that was 1.4 megabytes. CDs, that's about 700 megabytes, so about a tenth of a CD. Every single second could be processed by this camera. This was back in 2004, and now, 6 years later, it's 2010. So one of the faster cameras now is the Canon 70, and this was released back in 2009, and it is ridiculous. I think it's, I think it's 18 megapixels. It's either 15 or 18 megapixels, so it's 5,200 pixels wide by 3,500 pixels down, so it's huge. And it has support for more color than the 20D did, and it can do these at 8 times a second. And you multiply all of that together, and you realize that it's 240 megabytes per second. So it's about a CD worth of data every 2 to 3 seconds just by taking a whole bunch of photos over and over and over and over again. So it is an enormous amount of data that these cameras have to process. It's really, really impressive. And it's actually kind of scary when you realize that some of these photos, so for example, the photos that come out of the 7D are about 25 megabytes in size. I have bought more hard drives in the past year or so since I got the 7D that I've ever had to buy before, just because I keep eating through the hard drive space just by having these monstrously huge data files that come out of these cameras. And don't worry if some of these numbers don't mean much to you yet. They will, hopefully, pretty soon. Now, one thing that I do actually want to mention that's kind of humorous is that all of these digital cameras have screens on the back of them. And one of the things that I must point out to you to be careful of, because I'm sure by the end of the semester you'll be very proud of the images that you're producing out of your camera, one thing that I have to warn you about is this concept called chimping. Have any of you heard of this chimping process? And it's basically when you take a photo and you're looking at it on the screen and you go, ooh, 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 like that. You're so proud of the photo that you end up being a bit like a chimp. So be careful with that. Everybody does it, but try not to do it in front of too many of your E7 peers, or we will laugh and make fun of you. Okay, moving on. So I figure we can just talk a little bit about the history of some of the digital cameras that we have here, just very, very quickly. It's not going to take very long at all. So this is one of the first digital cameras ever created in 1975 by an engineer called Steven Sasson at Eastman Kodak. So it's sort of silly that I have to mention this, but Kodak used to be like one of the biggest film companies in the world. And now, because their people aren't buying film that much, you just don't see them around all that much anymore. But back in the day, they realized, okay, well, digital is the wave of the future, so that one of their engineers created this. It's a 9-pound monstrosity. It was a black and white camera, and it took 0.01 megapixel photos. 0.01 megapixels. Compare that to your cell phone, which might actually be able to produce 5 or 8 megapixels worth of photos. And this camera was very, very rudimentary, very, very basic. And beyond that, it took 23 seconds to take one photo. So we've just been talking about how modern digital cameras can process 18 megapixels worth of data 8 times a second in color, very, very quickly, all of this fancy stuff. And it took this one 23 seconds to take a 100 pixel by 100 pixel image. That's it. 0.01 megapixels, just 100 pixels by 100 pixel. Your screen on your cell phone is probably more than that, especially if you have a smartphone. Okay, so moving on a little bit, Canon decided that they wanted to do something kind of crazy and cool because, you know, they thought digital cameras are the wave of the future. They thought that they would hand over the design of a digital SLR over to a designer and see what sort of stuff they would come out with. So in 1983, Luigi Colani decided that he would go with an aquatic theme and design some SLRs that look like this. And it looks like these should be in use underwater, but unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, these designs have sort of gone by the wayside in favor of now our more classic SLR design. And so I said this was brief in terms of history, and it is. And so now we have to switch gears a little bit and talk in order for us to get a little bit of a basis for some of the stuff that we're going to be talking about throughout the semester, we do have to talk a little bit about numbers. And there is the teeniest, tiniest, itty-bittiest amount of math in this class, but don't let that scare you. It's not that bad. You will make it through just fine. And in order for us to have a basis for all of this, we have to talk about what a bit and a byte are. Because cameras are essentially computers, they communicate in the language of computers, which is binary, ones or zeros. And so we have the concept of a bit is very, very simple. It's just a zero or a one. One bit represents either a zero or a one, and that's it. Now, if we were to align 8 bits together, we would get one byte. So the sequence of 8 bits, of 8 zeros, 8 ones, or any combination thereof, is one byte. And if you realize that a bit can represent two values, right? So if we have 2 bits together, the one on the left can be either a 0 or a 1. The one on the right can either be a 0 or a 1. So how many different values can we have out of 2 bits worth of information? So 2 times 2, 4 values, right? So we could have 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. We could have 4 different values with 2 bits of information. So you realize, okay, 2 times 2. For 2 bits, it's 2 times 2, that's 4. So for 8 bits, it's 2 times 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 2. So 2 to the 8th power. So with 8 bits of information, or in one byte, we have 256 discrete values. So that goes from 0000000001 to 10000002, or no, 10, and then 11, and then 1, and then 100, so on and so forth. So you can have 256 different values just by counting in binary in this way with one byte. Okay, so hopefully many of you are at least familiar with this. And it's possible for us to convert a binary number to a decimal and back and forth, but we're not going to go through that. That's sort of useless math for this course. Now, if we take a look at a little bit bigger of a picture, it's not that useful in terms of the sheer quantity of data that modern cameras can compute. It's not that useful to talk just about bits or bytes. We usually have to prefix them with much larger quantities. So for example, you've probably all heard of kilobytes or megabytes or gigabytes, and these are just prefixes that tell you how many of those bits or bytes actually exist. So if we have a kilobyte, then that means that we have 1,024 bytes. And the reason that it's not 1,000 evenly is because it has to do with binary. 1,024 is actually 2 to the 10th power. It's just take it for granted that it's not quite 1,000. It's a little bit more than that. So when we are talking about megabytes, it's 1,024 kilobytes. And because 1 kilobyte is 1,024 bytes, multiply all that together and you realize that a megabyte is actually about 1,048,576 bytes. We can go on and on with gigabytes. And nowadays, we find hard drives and very large hard drives that have more than gigabytes. They have an additional layer that's not mentioned here, terabytes, which is 1,024 gigabytes. But for the purposes of this class and in terms of cameras, really the most useful ones are these kilo, mega, and giga. So what's most important, you don't have to remember that it's precisely 1,024. You can sort of remember that it's about 1,000. Just remember that it's not exactly 1,000. A kilobyte means about 1,000 bytes. A megabyte means about 1,000,000 bytes, and a gigabyte means about 1,000,000,000 bytes. Okay? Any questions on any of that? Now, this is very important because in order for us to be able to describe a photo, we have to be able to do it in terms of these bits and these bytes. So everything that you see on this screen is a result of this computer processing a whole bunch of ones and zeros. So there is some way that a computer, and by extension the camera, is able to process these photos and display these photos to you in color using just zeros and ones. So if we were to actually zoom in very, very close into this photo, so you'll notice that, and I apologize, the contrast is kind of low, but it's zooming in to a very small portion. Let's see, do I have a pointer? I don't have a pointer. But there's a little sort of bump in the wall that's up there, and we're zooming in very, very close into that. And so what we see is that this image is made up of small squares, this concept that I referred to earlier as pixels. Yes? I have to keep them on for the camera, but I can turn it off for just a second so we can take a look at, now hopefully you can see that, the small little bit that it's extending. But unfortunately, I do have to keep the lights on so that the camera can do this. Okay, so every one of these blocks that you see, there's a little square representing each of these, is one pixel. And so when we're talking about one pixel, if we were to break down all of these photos into one pixel, all of these pixels have a color. That color can be red, green, blue, brown, purple, cyan, any color. And it's made up by three so-called primary colors. And these are not primary colors in the elementary school sense, but primary colors in the computer sense. And computers think of primary colors in terms of red, green, and blue. So every single pixel, every block that you see on your computer screen, on your digital camera, on this projector, is made up of a pixel, and each pixel is made up of these three components, red, green, and blue. Now, each of these components is made up by 1 byte worth of information, 8 bits worth of information. So that means that I have 256 discrete possible values of red. So if we're just talking about red, 0, in essence, might mean completely black. There is a complete absence of red. Whereas 255, a value of 255, might mean the complete presence of red. So it is all red. It's very, very bright red. And we might have variations in the middle. So 128 might be like halfway between. 64 might be a sort of a dark, very, very deep red. Now, when we add in these additional colors, so green is also 8 bits. There's also 8 bits available for green. So we go from 0, which is the complete absence of green, 255, which is the complete presence of green. Or blue as well, the same thing. Complete absence at 0, the complete presence at 255. So if we have, for example, a color that is made up of 0 red, 0 green, and 0 blue, what color is that in the end? It's just black. It's the complete absence of every color. So what about if we had 0 for red, 255 for green, and 0 for blue? Yeah, it's just green. Now we could get a little bit fancier. What if we did like 255 for red, 255 for green, and 0 for blue? So it's sort of brownish. All right, easier might be 255, 0, and 255. That would be a purple, because you're mixing the blue and the red together. So all of these combinations, and all of the colors that you see are actually made up by just these 8 bits of information in each of this for each of these colors. So if you multiply 256 different shades of red times 256 shades of green times 256 shades of blue, you realize that this is actually an enormous number of different colors that we can actually represent just based on this one pixel. It's millions, millions and millions of colors that are available. Now, you'll notice that there is some text at the top that says JPEG. Now, JPEG is just a type of file that's on your computer that many or all of your cameras are capable of taking. And this is the default number of colors that a JPEG photo would have. So when you download a photo and it's a JPEG format, whether you're downloading it from your camera or from the internet or from another friend or from an email or what have you, by default, this is how each of those pixels are made up. It's made up with 1 byte of red, 1 byte of green, and 1 byte of blue. Now, this is an enormous number of colors. This is a lot of colors, but it is limited. There is a way that you would have, if you try to modify this JPEG, you would actually be able to see that you don't have enough discrete values. So there are other file types available as well, like the 16-bit TIFF, for example, that it's not the 16-bit TIFF. And it doesn't just double the number of available options. It's exponential, because 16 bits is 2 bytes of information, which means that there's 65,000 different values of red, 65,000 different values of green, 65,000 different values for blue. You multiply all that up together. I can't do that in my head. The number is very, very large. Compare that to the 256 that were available through JPEG. So it's just because we're doubling the number of bits doesn't mean that we're doubling the number of values. We are doubling it and then doubling it and then doubling it 8 times. So we're multiplying it again. We have another power of 8 associated with this. So we have a huge number of colors that are available to us in 16-bit TIFFs. And the reason that we might use this file format is if we want to save the image out of our camera in the highest quality possible. Now, many cameras don't actually support TIFF, but usually when you're working with an image on your computer, you have the option to save it as a 16-bit TIFF. And I would suggest that it's not really a good idea to send a 16-bit TIFF to your friends and family to share the file, but instead to use it as just a way for you to work with a particular image. It's a good working file format. It's not a good presentation file format because it's just not that popular. It's a huge file. It's not very popular of a file format. Everybody that, even many cell phones can look at JPEG files, so it's just usually a good idea when you're sending files around to use JPEG. But I present this to you as an alternate option to be able to work with files, to be able to work with your photographs in the highest possible quality. Yes?
If you're shooting in JPEG, are you automatically limited to the JPEG bit depth?
Yes. If you are shooting in JPEG, you are automatically limited to the JPEG bit depth. So the bit depth, to give you an idea, that's just the number of colors that we can provide in one pixel. So the bit depth of an 8-bit JPEG, for example, is much smaller than the bit depth of a 16-bit TIFF. So if you are taking your photos in the JPEG file format, you download them to your computer, you are, in essence, throwing away a huge number of pieces of data that your camera originally had. Your camera is capable of producing more colors than the 8-bit JPEG is capable of showing you. Now, it doesn't matter for a lot of reasons, and for other a lot of reasons, it does matter. But if you want the most quality out of your camera, 8-bit JPEG is not the way to go. But for many purposes, it's perfectly fine. But as you will see later, we're going to be talking about a file format called RAW, which is just a generic file format. Many cameras have a RAW file format, but the file format differs slightly. But the reason that it's called RAW is that it provides to you the highest possible picture quality because it is essentially the raw data that is coming off of the sensor. So you're not throwing away colors that you might have had to throw away for JPEG. But again, don't worry too much about that. We will talk more about RAW in the upcoming weeks. And one of the things you'll notice about this class is that it's very heavily teaser-based. So many of the things we have to just sort of wave our hands at and say, oh, you'll learn about that in the upcoming weeks. And it's not totally intentional. I mean, sure, I want you to stick around and watch all of these lectures, but it is very much for a reason that all of this stuff sort of intertwines together. And in order for us to talk about it, we have to have a basis for it, and then we can start talking about some of the more interesting things a little bit later. Okay. Now, moving on. Now, a lot of the files that an image. So, if we were to actually multiply the number of bits and bytes that make up an image. So if we have an image that's 8 megapixels, for example, so it was what, 5,000? No, it was 3,500 pixels across and 2,300 pixels down, something like that. You multiply that together, that's 8 million. And if you have just one byte worth of information for every single pixel, then that means that you have essentially 8 megabytes worth of information in that photo, right? Essentially 8 megabytes. But because we were saying that JPEG is actually 3 bytes of information for every pixel, 1 byte for red, 1 byte for green, 1 byte for blue, this means that it's actually 8 times 3, or 24 megabytes. And usually when you're working with images, you're not working with an image that is that large. And there's a variety of compression tactics that file formats use to try to get that size from a very large 24 megabytes to a much more manageable 1 or 2 or 3 or something like that. So usually the file that comes out of your camera in JPEG form is compressed, which means that they're using some tricks to try to make the file size smaller than what we would actually expect out of a file that is that large with that many colors. And one of the ways that we can compress something is something called run length encoding. And this is useful for use in what's called a GIF file format. You'll never use a GIF for your photographs, but it is a file format that was pretty popular on the internet. And a GIF, G-I-F, is basically just a very simple image like this. It's not well represented by a photograph, but I want to describe this to you as just as an example of a type of compression that you might find in a file. So both of these images are 300 pixels wide and 200 pixels down. Now, if we were to actually create, or if we were to actually figure out how many bytes this is, if we assume 1 byte for all of this, so 300 times 200 is what, 60,000, so about 60 kilobytes. So each of these files should be about 60 kilobytes large. Right, everybody, does that make sense to everybody? If I assume that 1 pixel is 1 byte worth of information, and I multiply the number of pixels wide by the number of pixels down to find out how many total pixels are in the image, I get about 60,000, which tells me that I have about 60 kilobytes worth of information here. Now, if I try to compress these using run length encoding, what I can do is look at I can look at each row individually. Look at the very first pixel in that row. So if we look at the German flag on the left here, we would see that the very top pixel, or the very top row, and the very far left pixel is the color black. So we might say, okay, this is the color black, and it looks like that color extends all the way to the right. So use this black color for the next 300 pixels. Then for the second row, it can say, okay, it's again black, so use this color for the next 300 pixels. So now what we've done is we've taken something that used to be 300 bytes long, and now it's just a couple of bytes, because now we can say it's just this one color 300 times. And that's why it's called run length encoding. We're just running across the width to try to determine what color is we have, or what colors we have in common, and try to compress them down. So we could compress this flag to be really small, because now, rather than having 300 pixels across, it's as if we only have 1 or 2. So this now is a much smaller. We can get this down to maybe a couple hundred bytes. And in fact, if we were to look at the actual file size, it is only a couple hundred bytes. Now instead, let's take a look at the French flag. And if we use the same idea for encoding, it compresses also, right? Because we would take the very top row. We would say, okay, the first pixel on the far left is what color? Blue, okay, and so blue extends for the next 100 pixels. Then it changes to white. Then that extends for the next 100 pixels. And then it changes to red, and that extends for the next 100 pixels. So we're still compressing it quite a bit, but it's not quite as efficient as it was for the German flag. And so for this reason, this is why we don't use run length encoding compression for photographs, because usually adjacent pixels, or pixels right next to each other, differ just ever so subtly, and so this won't work out very well. But again, this is shown to you as one way that we would be able to compress some images. So if we actually had a photo that looks like this, we had an apple in front of a solid blue background, we tried to encode this, then the blue background would encode pretty well, or it would compress pretty well, not encode, because we would be able to say, especially with the top row, okay, the first farthest left pixel is blue, all of the subsequent pixels are blue. But we have a problem when it comes to the apple itself, because the pixels differ. So there's no way for us to be able to compress that using this run length encoding. Any questions on that? Now, to give you an idea of how JPEG works, and JPEG is a bit more technical than that. JPEG breaks down the image into blocks. And it tries to throw away data that the researchers who created the JPEG file format decided that humans would not be able to accurately or very well decipher or see. So if you take a look at this image, for example, you'll notice that there are two. So I've zoomed in twice. On the left is the original image, and we can see the original pixels in it pretty easily. But on the right, we can see that it looks splotchy and blocky. And the reason for that is because of this JPEG compression. And again, this isn't the default JPEG compression. I've compressed it a lot to over-exaggerate what's happening. So you don't have to really worry about a JPEG file looking like this by default. It's just that I've over-compressed it. I've compressed it far too much, as is appropriate for this photo. And you can see that this photo is made up of blocks that try to use adjacent or similar colors to try to recreate the original image. And in this way, it's a much smarter compression method, but it is so-called lossy. And what lossy means is that it is throwing away data that used to be there. So there's obviously data in this image on the left that is no longer on the image on the right. Right? We've thrown away some of the color information in exchange for a smaller file size. And that means that JPEG is a lossy file format. So this is good and bad. This is good because that means that JPEG files are actually pretty small when they're on disk or on your camera's flash card. They don't take up a lot of space compared to uncompressed. But it does mean that you have inherently thrown away some data, no matter how minuscule, you have thrown away some data in the JPEG file format. So whenever you save a file as JPEG, you are at risk for losing some of this data. So if you are taking photos with your camera in the JPEG file format, that's perfectly fine. Don't get concerned by the fact that it is a lossy file format. You probably never noticed, or if you did, then you're probably aware of the implications, but you may not have never noticed up until now that it was throwing away data. And so you should not be concerned about it at this point, except with one exception. That is that if you're going to be modifying these files, I highly, highly recommend that you save the original JPEG that comes out of your camera, because that original JPEG will never be the same again. If you modify it ever so slightly and then resave it as a JPEG file, it is going through, again, this lossy compression, and you might be throwing away some extra bits that used to be there. So I recommend having two copies. If you're going to modify your JPEG file, I recommend having two copies. One that is original copy from the camera that you never touch again. Then the other one you can do whatever you want, because if for some reason you need to revert back to the original, it will be much more difficult with a modified version than from a copied version of the original file. Okay, now there are file formats that are lossless. And what this means is that they are still able to compress the data contained within them, but it does so without actually throwing away important pieces of data. So this run length encoding that we talked about, it does compress the size, right? But we are able to uncompress it. We are able to revert back to the original image as it was exactly before we did the compression. And this is lossless compression. So JIF files are lossless. PNG files are lossless. PSD, PSD is a Photoshop file. I don't actually know what they use, but I'm going to assume that it's lossless because of how large the images are, and also that people would get very mad if they realized that Photoshop is saving your very important work in a lossy format. So I'm going to assume, but I don't know for sure, that it is a lossless, and TIFF is also lossless. So the color that we can represent with each of these file formats also differs. So JPEG, this is what we talked about before. We have three colors at 8 bits each. So that means that we have essentially 24-bit color available to us in a JPEG file. Now a GIF, and another reason why GIF is not suitable for photographs, is that you only have 8 bits worth of information for the entire image. So that means that you can only have 256 different colors in a JPEG image in its entirety. And that's just not going to work for photographs. It will look very pixelated. It will look very weird, the colors. So we don't actually use GIF. So I should also mention, because I've been yelled at before that I didn't clarify this, so while you can only represent 256 different colors in a GIF, it uses what's called a palette. So you can have 256 different colors, but you can specify what all of those colors are. So if you have an image that is only made up, let's say you somehow have a photograph that is only made up with 256 different colors, then GIF would be fine because you can select from a 24-bit palette for that subset of images. If you're not sure what I'm talking about, don't worry about too much about it. Just realize that GIF has far fewer colors that you can display in an image than you can with the much more popular JPEG file format. Now, Ping seems to be sort of the best of both worlds if we're going to look at it from these limited aspects. That is that it is lossless, so it retains all of the original quality while still being a smaller file size, and it has the JPEG quality 24-bit worth of color. So we have quite a high bit depth with Ping, but the problem with Ping is that because it is a lossless compression, it does not compress as well as JPEG. So the files are larger. For the same photograph, the file for a Ping would be a larger file format, or would be a larger file than for JPEG. So if you were going to send this to some of your friends or your family, having a Ping might make the difference between having an email that will send and an email that won't send because of the size of the image itself, or the file size, not the number of pixels within the image. PSD, this is the Photoshop file. It can store an enormous amount of colors, 48 bits. This is like that 16-bit TIFF. There's 16 bits worth of information for each of the three primary colors, but you will only use this as an intermediate format. You'll only use this to save files that you're working on, to save Photoshop files that you're going to modify at a later point in time. You won't ever submit, or you won't ever send a PSD file to someone else unless they're also going to work on the Photoshop file. It's not good to show off your images. JPEG is a far better format for that. And TIFF is sort of similar to PSD in that same idea, in that it's good as a working format and good as an archiving format, but it is not good as a format to send. So alpha, the column on the far right, that just talks about transparency. So all images in a computer have to be rectangular by nature. They have a width and they have a height. They can never be circular. But if you have transparency, you can make it look like it's a circle, for example, just because you can have a circular image and then the surrounding pixels can be transparent, so whatever is behind it will appear that way, and that is all that alpha is. So JPEG doesn't support it, which makes perfect sense since cameras can only take rectangular pictures anyway. And a lot of these other formats, like GIF and Ping, are really web formats. They're formats that you would find for images on the web, and you will often find them that have some transparency. So an example of this is if you go to Google Maps, for example, and you search for something on Google Maps and the little pin drops, you know how that pin is sort of shaped like circular and then it has the little pointy thing at the bottom? That is a transparent ping because you can still see the map behind it, if that makes sense. So that is the alpha that I'm referring to. It is not that it's making your computer transparent, it's that it just shows you what is behind it. If they had used JPEG for that little marker icon, then you would not see the map behind it. They would have to fill it in with color like white or black or gray or something like that, and it just would not be as pretty. Phew. Any questions on any of this information? All right. Gonna take a drink from my lens. Yeah. Why did I go into file formats as opposed to lenses? For what?
Well, as opposed to staying with the hardware of the camera. I'm just curious. Because I understand about this because there's some web development, but I can see how it might be a little confusing for at a class. But I'm just wondering to understand why you're showing it now as opposed to in the next class.
The reason is that the way that this, and this is sort of a perfect segue into what we will be talking about in the upcoming classes, we have to provide some context for how a file is being stored and saved on a camera. So in order for us to be able to create photos for the assignment and be able to upload them, it's useful to have some of this discussion now because we are not going to be talking about software. I guess next time. But it's sort of a precursor to what is coming up in the next week, and then we sort of skip over a lot of this stuff. We go back to the hardware for these lectures 3 through 5, kind of through 6, and then starting in 6, we bring this back up. But it's good to start talking about this now because of the assignments, for one thing, and also because it does provide sort of a basis for us to have some more sophisticated discussions, even though we will be talking about hardware in the future. So this is not meant, of course, to be a scare tactic or to scare you into submission or anything like that. This is just meant to be a precursor and to start building a foundation for some of the technical talk that I will be referring to, because pretty much in every lecture I will be talking about bits and bytes and these things, and it's helpful to that you know what they are now rather than me going through half the semester and everybody's wondering what on earth is a bit, what is a byte in terms of in technical terms. Yes, did you have a question?
Question for RGB is one of the buttons. Do we work with special colors as well, like yellow, or because we have RGB as for the devices, the CCDs or whatever device we're using. Mm-hmm. But is there another arrangement for other types of colors as well as, for example, yellow?
So you're talking about on the sensor itself?
Yes.
So, okay, so good question. So on the sensor itself, there's, and we won't talk about this until lecture 9 or 10, but just to give a basic answer for this question, and it was that, well, what about in the cameras that have support for other colors like yellow? And there are, depending on the sensors typically also have arrangements on them. There's a filter in front that's arranged in a color, green, red, and blue, etc. Some of them also have some special colors like cyan or yellow, but that doesn't matter when we're talking about the files themselves, because all of these have to be written in the same file formats, which is this RGB, the red, the green, and the blue. So it doesn't matter what sort of colors the camera can read and can understand. It has to describe all of those colors in this same way, using the red, the green, and the blue only. So even if the camera has special support, and again, we'll talk more about it in upcoming lectures, even if it has special support for different colors like cyan and yellow, then it doesn't matter ultimately because it is still saved in the same file format.
The question is because the representation of the actual real color set, let's say for a vegetable that's green, mostly green, does it have any influence? Like, is there a type of misrepresentation from the real color and what the device actually can extract from it?
Yes, cameras actually battle constantly with color correction. So because of the same filter that's in front of it, the camera actually makes guesses about what the color should be and what it should not be. And sometimes those guesses are incorrect. And the argument is that by having a filter that supports these special colors like yellow or cyan, it can make better educated guesses. But in the end, it seems to be sort of a moot point. And again, we will talk more in depth about this later on. I don't mean to trivialize your question or to skip over it, but just that it's very difficult to talk about why and technical reasons this happens without having talked about a lot of other things first. But in the end, I don't think it matters that much. There's a lot of marketing speak. I think Sony cameras, especially from a few years ago, they had these. They always talked about, oh, we have these special sensors that can detect cyan and yellow, and the photos are going to be really awesome, but it's just sort of a trick, and it's more marketing than anything else. And in the end, what happens in a typical camera, because they've been researched so heavily with just the standard red, green, and blue, is that we get sort of the same image quality out of it in the end, because the advantage is it's sort of overcome by the experience that the manufacturers have now with this red, green, and blue. If that makes sense. But again, that is exactly the topic that we will be talking about later. Okay, so in this class, so there are four projects. Assignments, as they're called. Assignment one is already out. All assignments will be released 3 weeks prior to when they're due. So this first assignment is due on September 21st. The next one will be released then. We'll keep going that way. There's those four assignments and one final project. And in terms of expectations, you are expected to attend or watch lecture videos. And as you can tell, we're actually taping these lecture videos, thanks to Chris Thayer, our videographer. And we will be posting the videos on the course website. You can view them as many or as few times as you want. If you need to miss a class for whatever reason, you will be able to catch up with one of the lecture videos. The downside to that is that, and it's a very small downside, but it is a downside nonetheless, is that it does take us time to edit and post the video. So it will be a couple of days between when the lecture occurs to when the video will be posted. So if you rely purely on the lecture videos, you may find that it gets a little bit close to when the lecture video is released to when the next assignment is due. So you must weigh this advantage or disadvantage to your own experience. But for the most part, we hope that you will enjoy the videos, because I talk quickly and there's a lot of material for us to cover. So hopefully you will be able to relearn or continue your learning that way by rewatching any one of these lectures. There's no exams or anything like that, and that's a good thing. If you were not worried about that, you potentially should have been, because the first year this class was offered, we had exams, and from what I hear, they were absolutely brutal. So be glad that all of those questions are now in assignments, and you can now get help that way through Open Book. So just to reiterate all of these are the expectations that we have for you. You attend or watch the lectures, the four assignments, the one final project, and there are zero exams. Now, if you are not for credit, if you are taking this class not for credit, but you're still registered, you're still welcome to complete the assignments. The difference is that you will not receive a grade or credit at the end of the semester. Let's see. Also, when we're talking about the final project, after the final project is due, the very last day of class, we will actually be having a computer science fair with another class, Computer Science E75, Building Dynamic Websites. And it's just a fun way for you to show off your photos to people from not only this class, but also in that other class. You might be registered in both, actually. And it's a fun way for those folks to be able to show off their own work. And usually you will see sort of an interesting intersection where some people from E75 have actually created like image galleries, and people from E7 have been interested in those to be able to show off their own work. And so this will be a fun way for you to mingle with your classmates, mingle with another class, show off your own work, and eat some cake. And it will be a fantastic time. The date is December 14th, I believe. It's in lieu of a final exam for this class during the normal time, 5:30 to 7:30. Don't have a location yet, but we will, of course, update you when that happens. Now, pretty much the central hub of where all of the data, all of the information, all of the videos for this course will be found on the course website, cse7.org. If you haven't seen it yet, it is at that location. Let's see, cse7.org. It looks like this. You will find that all of the assignments, all of the handouts that we have, except for the sectioning form, all of the handouts that we've given out today, excuse me, are available here. So, for example, assignments, you will go to the assignments link. And by the way, you will be able to find under the assignments page that there are links to some of the useful things. I will flesh this out in a little bit after lecture tonight. But you'll notice that one of the first things that you have to do as part of the assignment is to actually create and register a Flickr username with us. And that's called the E7 setup. The link to that is available here. And it's a relatively short three-step process. Well, technically four, but I cheat and call it three. Three-step process that allows you to join Flickr if you haven't already, authenticate with Flickr, and it basically just connects your account with E7, and then you verify that you are registered for the course, and then you join the Flickr group. Now, the Flickr group is actually where you will submit all of your photo assignments. Oh, it's not logged in, darn it. So you will actually submit all of your photo assignments to the Flickr group. And now there will be, in a lot of the assignments, there will be text answers as well. You will not submit those to the group. Instead, you will email that to pset@cse7.org. It's all on the assignment, so I'm just reiterating this for completeness sake. You'll email us only, no photos, you'll email us only the text answers. You'll post the photos to Flickr.
Now, the advantage to Flickr is that it is a Flickr group, so we can see each other's photos. You'll be able to look at everybody else's comments, critique on them, and you will be able to start discussions. So if you have questions that are maybe a little bit more general, maybe not appropriate during lecture, you would be able to ask them here on the discussion board, and hopefully all of you will participate. If you see a question that you want to answer, you should feel free to do so. Now, one of the nice things about the way that we have this set up is that you do not actually have to, when you sign up for Flickr and you create a username, your username does not have to have your name in it. It can be whatever you want. By performing this step too, by authenticating with Flickr, and then by telling us your last name and first name, we compare the Flickr ID that you've authenticated with against your registration. So we have your name associated sort of in our server in the back. You don't have to worry about putting your name up on Flickr at all. You can post them anonymously or pseudo-anonymously under whatever name you would like to do, and that's certainly fine. Now, if you already have a Flickr account, you will have to decide whether or not you want to use that with E7. The downside to using an already existing Flickr account with E7 is that there are some photos that are a little repetitive. There are some, just by necessity of having some of these assignments, there are some that just differ very slightly or significantly in exposure effects only, but it's the same scene. And that you might find that to clutter your own Flickr account a little bit, especially if you have a portfolio of images that, you know, is sort of your best work that you're representing or what have you. So in that case, you might consider having a separate Flickr account just for E7. And that would be fine to have a separate Flickr account that you associate with E7. Now, one more thing is that Flickr does have a free account and a paid account. You do not have to do the paid account. You can get simply the free account and it will be sufficient. That's the other reason why you might not want to use your existing Flickr account for E7 as well, is that if you upload a lot of other photos, you might run into the free account limitation. You can only upload so many photos or a certain number of combined file size of photos in 1 month through Flickr. And if you are sharing E7 with your own, then you might run into that limitation unless you have the paid account. So again, that might be another reason why you get your own account. But if you have your own account for E7, you will not run into any of the image upload requirements unless you do something really crazy or unknown or obnoxious, like upload a 300 megapixel image and something like that. So anyway, the Flickr group is, let's see, maybe I will be able to show it to you. There's not much that's available yet, just because I think it is, for right now, just the staff and I. Let's see, E7 2010. But basically, all of your images, yeah, it looks woefully empty for right now, but I will post a little bit later to get the discussion started for assignment one, and you will continue the discussion with your own forum. And I should have had a copy back here, but for a portion of it, you will just be uploading a photo that you like and talking about it a little bit. That will be under a discussion. That's just sort of to kickstart the discussions and get you used to Flickr and get you used to a lot of these things. If you're not familiar with Flickr, if you're not comfortable with uploading images, there's quite a bit of help, not only available on Flickr, but also when we start offering sections. Now, sections are something else entirely. It is not a required aspect of the course, but you might find it useful. It is that we will have one or two weekly sections. Although they are optional, they are highly recommended, and we will go over the same material that we go over in lecture, but in greater detail we will cover any questions that you might have. And again, because some of this stuff we have to, by necessity, go sort of quickly, it might be good to hear it twice or three times in section, and you'll be able to solidify your own knowledge that way. And again, section would be a good place if you have problems or questions uploading images or tagging images. That would be a good place to do that as well. Now, if you do have questions for us, you can email the staff at staff@csc7.org. Right now, the staff consists of Chris Thayer, John Selig, who's in the back, he can wave, and myself. We might be getting, depending on enrollment, we might be getting another TF as well.
And that person will be on the staff lists at the appropriate time. But if you do have questions that you deem inappropriate for the discussion board, you can send them here as well. But by default, I would wager or I would suggest that many questions might be appropriate for the discussion board, just because then you would be able to get a plethora of answers and everybody would be able to benefit from your particular question. So there's a couple of, so I've already talked about Flickr. There's a link to the Flickr group on the course website, but this is what the URL looks like so that you are not confused by it. Now, something that's very important that I must mention is that you do not have to own a camera to complete this course. You might find it much easier if you do, but you don't have to. And I should say that if we do have some requirements for, if you're going to use your own camera, we do have some kind of easy requirements. That is two things. Your camera must support the RAW image format. Not all do. That actually gets rid of a huge number of compact cameras. Pretty much all SLRs support RAW formats. Higher-end compact cameras will support the RAW format. And additionally, the second thing is that it must support manual mode. So in other words, you must be able to set all of the exposure settings manually. Now, if your camera does not support one or both of these things, you still might be able to use it for maybe the first assignment or maybe one and a half assignments, but very quickly you will realize that you will then have to use one of the course cameras. Now, we have available, not through the course, but through the extension school, a couple of Panasonic Lumix cameras like that looks like this that has both of these features that supports both RAW and the manual mode. Unfortunately, many years ago, we started out with 10. Now they tell me we're down to about 5 or so. And when you check these out, you don't rent them. You don't have to pay anything for them. But you can check them out. You go to 53 Church Street, the 53 Church Street Lab. You go up to There's a media lab, media access lab or something. I can't remember quite what it's called, but there's a desk. You tell them you want to rent one of the cameras for an extension school course. They'll direct you as appropriate. You will borrow one of these. You will give them probably, I think what they do is they have you give them your Harvard ID or something like that, and then you can use it for 24 hours. And yes, that's a bit of a restriction, and I have fought for years to extend that, but unfortunately they won't budge. It's only 24 hours. You can come back and, you know, recheck it out or what have you, but do be considerate. There's 5 of these cameras for everybody in this class. And so you do have to be mindful. So don't wait. Don't procrastinate on your assignments, please. I don't want to hear anybody that cannot submit their assignments because they have not had access to the cameras. So do be mindful of this. Did I see a question in the back?
Sure. Is this course going to cover ways of backing up data that, because like my camera, for example, will take like memory cards, but they're not
Yeah, we will be talking about that in probably the next lecture, archiving and that sort of thing. But that's also a topic that is difficult to address in one go, and you will hear that certainly throughout the duration of the class. Okay, so with that said, I had more that we'll leave till next week, but thank you all for coming. Hope to see you again next week, and we will see you then.